This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 27th, 2014. This podcast is presented by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Any use of this audio without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated or your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm going to go ahead and take a look this week at some of the developments we've had over the past few days in federal taxes. We're going to start with a field attorney advice that takes a look at some interactions of some rules that were actually passed in 2008 and 2009, but are beginning to have some impact now rolling forward. The question became, in 2008 and 2009, you may remember, if you had a net operating loss under the special 3 to 5 year rule, where you could elect how far to carry it back, there was also a special rule that said such losses could be used to offset 100% of 10 to minimum taxable income instead of just the 90% that normally an alternative tax net operating loss is limited in offsetting. The question had arisen, given the way the law was written, how we used up those 2008-2009 years. Did we essentially hold 2008 and 2009 NOLs and only use them after we'd either exhausted the the other years, including years after 10, 11, 12, or do we go ahead and just use them in order? And the question occurred because the way the law was written, it talked about giving you 90% and then a special extra 10% calculation for the 8 and 9 NOLs. Some people had reinterpreted that to mean that in essence, you first use any other net operating loss up to the 90%, and then, assuming you either hit the 90, if you hit the 90, you would fill in the 10% with your remaining 8 or 9. Or, if you hadn't hit the 90, then the 8 or 9 would go ahead and fill you up from all the way up to the 100 if possible. That would, in essence, defer the 8 and 9 NOLs into the future. In the field attorney advice, the IRS concluded that, in fact, that is not what happens. The Chief Counsel's Office concluded that that special calculation only talks about the amount of net operating loss from the overall pool you're allowed to use. But the actual amounts that are used are still done the same first-in, first-out basis we've always used. So in essence, you will exhaust the 8 and 9 NOLs and chewing up the 90% once they come up in their order, as opposed to being able to reserve them into the future and use them to just offset the special 10% of AMT. Probably won't affect a lot of taxpayers, but some taxpayers who it does affect could be significant. Obviously, this is the sort of issue that's just now coming to the forefront because otherwise those 8 and 9 NOLs would be exhausted, and some taxpayers are arguing they're not. We also had a memorandum issued by the Large Business International Division of the IRS, LBNI Memorandum 0408-14007. This deals with mixed service costs for utilities who are constructing property. The memo notes that they cannot use the simplified service cost method, and then outlines, and I won't go into details here because it probably doesn't affect most of you who don't do electric utilities, but if you do, you probably want to go get this memo that takes a look at a safe harbor effectively method where they will not challenge you if you're using a consistent headcount ratio and a production ratio with a limited reduction for purchased electricity and purchased natural gas. But it also continues to discuss that in some areas, you cannot include any of the following items in the allocation of mixed service costs. That would include additional costs of working in an energized environment, treated as costs of maintaining electric service, overly broad or inappropriate cost drivers, and imputation of production costs based on hypothetical events. As well, it does not cover, they note, this memorandum doesn't cover the following threshold issues, which is whether a particular cost is a mixed service cost, or whether a department is a service department that generates both capitalizable service costs and deductible service costs. Obviously, if you're in the utility industry, you want to go ahead and take a look at this memo. Again, most taxpayers obviously are not in that industry, not going to be a key issue for them. In the case of Engstrom, Lipscomb, and Lack, APC versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-221, we run smack into a problem of a law firm that ended up losing over $3 million in deductions due to the fact that they both kept inadequate records and they ended up having a shareholder pay expenses personally rather than the company pay the expenses, both of which ended up costing the firm dramatically. Now, given the numbers, you probably wouldn't be surprised to discover this was a very successful law firm with successful attorneys who also, by the way, had aircraft. the aircraft proved to be our problem. Under Section 274D, there are very strict rules for documenting certain expenses, not the least of which would be this particular aircraft. And you have to document various items for travel, not just that you incurred an expense, not just that basically the plane was used, but who was on the plane, why were they on the plane, what was the business purpose, what's the nature of what went on. And while they kept all kinds of records about the actual flight times and, you know, flying of the planes, there was very little documentation regarding the business purpose of the taxpayers' trips. The tax court allowed some reconstruction of proof of that because it does need to be, if we can reconstruct it from contemporaneous records that are maintained at the time, will allow it, but otherwise not allowed. Secondly, another problem came that one of the shareholders of the law firm had been paying expenses directly for these aircraft expenses instead of having the law firm pay them. Now, they had had the corporation deduct these expenses, and the attorney had claimed at trial, well, of course, yeah, I paid them, we deduct them on the corporate return, but all that really means is the company owes me money. And the tax court said, sorry, guys, here's your problem. There's no documentation currently that there was any expected debt, that the debt was real, was expected to be repaid, or that anybody was accounting for it. And because of that lax record keeping, we're denying the deduction. At the end of the day, their deduction for these travel expenses went from over $4 million to under $1 million by the time we finished. Record keeping is important, and taxpayers need to understand that, by the way, when the service is going to win on one this size, that means on exam, there's going to be a very, very high probability that the agent is simply going to deny anything that doesn't have records, and the taxpayer can't really try to argue that, well, you know, obviously I incurred the expense. The whole purpose of 274D is to require taxpayers to keep detailed records in this area and not to allow taxpayers to argue that, well, you should give me a reasonable amount. This week, we began to get the cost of living numbers in various areas, and the first set out, as is often true, are the information related to pensions and Social Security. This week, IRS issued news release IR 2014-99. It lays out a number of key changes in pension, retirement plans, IRAs. Generally, as always, since inflation has not been running at super high levels in recent years, we do not have numbers jumping dramatically, but we do have some things going up. For instance, this year, the maximum allocation limit in a defined contribution plan is going to rise from $52,000 to $53,000. The amount of compensation we can consider in an employer retirement plan for such allocations or for computing defined benefit will rise to $265,000 for $260,000. Catch-up contributions in 401ks and similar plans will rise from $6,000 from $5,500. The elective deferrals in a 401k will go from $17,500 to $18,000. The amount for highly compensated employees, remember in various tests we have to worry about whether employees considered highly compensated under the code, that number will increase from $115,000 to $120,000. The deferral limitation for simple accounts will rise from $12,000 to $12,500, and the catch-up contribution in a simple account will go to $3,000 from $2,500. The compensation limit, that limit of which we look for how much did people have in the prior 3 years to count for a countable year for whether we have to include them in the SEP, will rise from $550 to $600, not normally a major issue because at those low levels, either most people qualify automatically if they worked at all, but nevertheless, that number still jumped. And the Roth IRA maximum contribution phase-outs moved this year. Maximum contribution phase-out will begin $183,000 for a married couple filing a joint return, up from $181,000. And for a single person or a head of household that is not married filing separate, it will rise to $116,000 from $114,000. Remember, married separate, it phases out from 0 to 10. Social Security issued their news releases this week, and let's start with the self-employment tax. What really happens here is that the Social Security limit for a quarter of coverage goes to $1,220 this year. That means that if you're using the non-farm optional method or the farm optional method, some of the numbers related to that change. The lower limit for the optional methods will be $4,880. The upper limit will be $7,320 for 2015. An individual member qualifies for the optional non-farm method only if they meet the following three conditions. That is, they had net non-farm profits for the year of less than $5,284. The net non-farm profits were less than 72.189% of the individual's gross non-farm income. And the individual had earnings from self-employment of at least $400 in each of the three prior years. A taxpayer computing under the non-farm optional method will compute their earnings on the smaller of two-thirds of gross non-farm income, or $4,880 for 2015. Taxpayers that qualify to use the farmer's optional method have to meet the following criteria. Their gross farm income has to be not more than $7,320, or their net farm profits have to be less than $5,284. In that case, the amount will be allowed will be the lesser of two-thirds of gross farm income, or $4,880 for 2015. If a taxpayer qualifies to use both methods, the total earnings from self-employment may not exceed $4,880 for 2015. Social Security also gave us the standard Social Security wage-based limit for Social Security, so withholding on Social Security taxes will rise this year to $118,500 in 2015, up from $117,000 this year. The Social Security Administration also had information on Medicare premiums for the year. The Medicare premiums for 2015 will not rise. In fact, and we still have the same basic structure there, so it'll be $104.90 per month. As mentioned, the $104.90 per month is going to, of course, trip in and will kick up if they had higher income in 2013. You may want to warn some of your taxpayers. Those tables, they don't really change from last year, but basically we have that. Remember, anybody who had more than on an individual return, $85,000 or more than $85,000 of adjusted gross income, on a joint return, more than $170,000 of gross income, will end up paying a Medicare Part B premium of more than $104.90. That maximum premium, if the income for a single individual or goes above $214,000, a joint return above $428,000, or a married filing separate return above $129,000, the premium will rise all the way to $335.70 per month for Part B. The other thing that changes here is the Social Security domestic worker threshold amounts for 2015 were announced. Those did not change. They will remain at the same $1,900 that we had in 2014. Finally, let's close out with a case here that reminds us about mailing is more complicated than we think it is. This is a case of Sanchez versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-223. Now, this involves filing a tax court position, but the code section involved is the same one involves timely filing a tax return, and the rules are identical. Mr. Sanchez, on the last day for filing his tax court petition to protest his exam result, printed out a mailing label from stamps.com. You may have heard of that. You may use that. It's a mailing service very similar to a postage meter, except obviously you use a computer to print out the label, and you have a little scale attached to your computer, and you print out the postage. All those things happen. It will handle certified mail. So he printed out a certified mail label from stamps.com. However, that label is covered generally under the rules for postage metered mail as general, and just like the traditional Pitney Bowes postage meter, same problem, that date's not really going to cover it, except in very limited circumstances. So, of course, we have to take that envelope down to the post office. Mr. Sanchez gave it to, apparently, an assistant. He didn't take it down, somebody else did. That person went to the post office, discovered the lines were long. Didn't really want to, and they took the rest of the office mail that day. They didn't want to wait in line to hand the postage to a clerk inside the post office. So there's a mail drop at the post office. They just simply put the envelopes into the mail drop in the post office and left. It turns out that the Postal Service did not actually get around to processing that stuff until the next day. It's not clear whether the Postal Service simply didn't pick up when they were supposed to, or whether in fact that person was past the last drop date, but it's irrelevant. For whatever reason, didn't happen, and a U.S. Postal Service postmarked a day later was placed on the envelope. Mr. Sanchez claimed that he should be granted the presumption he timely filed because he had a log from stamps.com showing that in fact the postage had been printed on the last day for filing. He had the testimony of this person stating they took it to the post office and dropped it in the postal slot. The problem is the law doesn't say that. In fact, what Section 7502A1 tells us is you only are deemed to be timely filed if the postmark on the envelope is dated no later than the day for filing. The only way you can prove that, obviously, when once a person dropped in the slot, they have no control over when the Postal Service will apply that stamp. So how the law allows you to get around that is if you file certified mail per the regulations and you get the white certified mail receipt with the date and time stamp, that's your postmark, and that will be proof of when you mailed it. However, this person who didn't want to stand in line didn't get that stamped receipt from a, and it has to be from a U.S. Postal Service employee. You can't get that receipt from, let's say, a mailboxes, etc., or I guess these days are UPS stores, who may offer certified mailing services, but their receipt's not relevant. It's got to be the one the postal employee finally stamps. If you don't have that, you don't prove timely filing. In this case, what Mr. Sanchez had was an envelope that effectively under the law proved he had not timely filed the return. And that proved to mean, or timely filed the petition, and that proved to mean that Mr. Sanchez would not have his day in court on the tax matter. This has been the Nichols Patrick Federal Tax Update for the week of October the 27th. Be sure to join us next week as we'll go over the updates and developments for that week, and we'll talk to you about what's happened then.